Welcome to the latest edition of the Wax Ecstatic Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Once again, thanking you for taking a few minutes out of your day to go down the memory lane of your baseball card collection via my baseball card collection and the big old monster box of cards as we continue to go set by set, year by year. A lot of fun going through the 80s and some interesting sets from the 90s. We're right in the middle of the 1991 sets, and we're taking a look at 91 Score, which the more I look at it, the more I kind of sort of like it, but then I realize how many of these cards are still out there and how the 91 Score set may be the ultimate example of baseball card gluttony by one company way back when, because this set was a monstrous set. You know, we talk about the monster box. Well, this was a monster set of 893 cards broken up over two series. And there's still about 893 million of these cards out there. So if you want to collect this set, trust me, there is plenty of product available at incredibly, insanely cheap prices. Now we'll talk about 91 Score and our random pull slamming Sammy Sosa card number 256. And it's actually because of this card, I kind of look back at the 91 Score set fondly. So it's a delicate balancing act here. You've got these somewhat nice cards, actually. These sharp cards with a very distinct 1991 look. It's very much like the In Living Color 1990 Score set, the Hammer Pants 1990 top set. But 91 Score definitely had a contemporary look then. It looks very dated now. But what really makes it look good is, in this particular case, that Sosa card has a black border. And talk about dated. Sosa is wearing the 1917 Chicago White Sox throwback unis. This was in the final season of Comiskey Park, and there was a little bit of a love for the old White Sox because Field of Dreams had come out, I want to say, about 2 years earlier. So there was a lot of desire to just kind of have this, you know, time machine, let's go back 60, 70 years feel. And the White Sox certainly caught that with this turn back the clock day. And I think Score really caught it with this great shot of Sosa actually connecting with the ball. He struck out a lot. So this was a rare sight to be seen. And that actually leads me to a question that we posted on Twitter yesterday and have gotten some great responses to, and I'm sure we'll get a few more. And with that, let's go to our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. We always appreciate your commentary there. Now, before we talk about the throwbacks, let's talk about a couple of the topics you brought up in some previous conversations, starting with our previous podcast on the 91 Bowman set. Now, the 91 Bowman set, I like. Not everybody likes it. They still think it's plain. It's very common. I like it because while it is plain, it's also simple. But this was a pivotal set for Bowman because that really set the stage for their designation as the card set of the rookies. If you liked rookie players or even pre-rookies, I mean, they had, you know, pictures and stats and cards of guys that wouldn't make it to the major leagues for another couple years, then the 91 Bowman set was really the launching point for that style of set. And to this day, Bowman still does that. But I've always liked 91 Bowman for a number of reasons. The plentiful amount of good rookies, and especially players who turned out to be superstars in the 1990s and early 2000s, some already in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Also, I like the look, I like the feel, and as I mentioned, I like the smell. And I explained there is, and you can only find this in cards that were made in 1991 or prior, and only through Topps and Bowman in particular, even though Fleer and Donruss had bubblegum in their cards in 1981. It was a different type of gum, and they had different card stock, and the gum stuck to the card stock, even worse than Topps gum did. So it's not quite the same feel there. But if you get an old pack of Topps or Bowman cards, and you've got the bubblegum in there, you have this really unique combination of bubblegum wax in most cases. 1991, they were in cellophane, but wax in most cases, and of course, cardboard. And it's a very intoxicating smell. And if you're a collector, you love that smell. And Peter Steinberg responded to that. He said, I love that gum cardboard wax smell too. When they do the baseball card reboot of Apocalypse Now, you can play Duval. Yes, I love the smell of bubblegum and cardboard and wax in the morning. It doesn't quite roll off the tongue exactly the same, to be honest with you. I'm not the only one. I can think of a lot of baseball card collectors, even if you don't collect much now. You know, you're listening to this podcast less because of cards that you've bought recently, but because, you know, you bought the same cards that I did 25, 30 years ago. You know that smell. And as I mentioned in that podcast, even if you end up just buying a lot of old wax packs for a few bucks, when you really rip into the true wax packs and you get that smell again, it brings back a lot of great memories. Like I said, it's just like the smell of fresh baked chocolate chip cookies. It will remind you of your days going to your grandma's house for the holidays or something along those lines. That smell triggers a lot of great memories for not just me, but a lot of collectors. Now, speaking of ripping through some old packs, Joey W. sent us a picture. Looks like a shoebox with roughly 30 packs in there. It says, about to dust off the shoebox of unopened late 80s, early 90s packs. I'll let you know how the gum held up. Well, I can only hope you held up, Joey, because that is pretty disgusting if you actually eat that gum. And just scanning through what I can see from this box, I actually see 91 Bowman football. And I remember buying a few packs of those, not too many, but 91 Bowman football didn't quite get the love that baseball got. I think the card design and Topps started going cheap with some of their designs here. They basically used the same design for football, baseball, and hockey even, starting around 1991 and 92. So, you know, the Bowman football look didn't quite play as well as the baseball look, but I hope you found a few decent cards in there. I also see it looks like some late 80s Topps football, maybe like 87 or 88. NBA hoops, I remember those. And I didn't see this until you pointed it out later, Joey, but you did have that rack pack of 82 Topps, the grocery store rack pack. Now, you didn't post any pictures of Cal Ripken Jr., so I'm assuming you didn't get that card there, but I hope you found some real gems going through that box. And especially when you're pulling cards from packs from the glutton days of baseball cards, the late 80s and early 90s, if you're doing it just for the fun of it, and just to see what's in there, that's harmless fun. And in most cases, it's cheap. But definitely don't go trying to build a financial portfolio with the good cards that you pull out of there. Because if you're lucky, even in a shoebox full of roughly 30 packs, and including an 82 Topps rack pack, you might get $30 to $35 worth of cards. Might. That's a stretch. You're assuming that in one of those packs, you get a card that's worth about 75 cents or a dollar, because everything else is going to be a nickel. All right, Tim Murray talking about 91 Bowman. Don't think I ever voluntarily bought a pack of these when they came out. I was over Bowman after the first two sets. Yeah, I would say you're not the only one, Tim. I'm sure there are quite a few collectors when they saw the recent release from Bowman in 1991. They just went, eh, it's Bowman. And of course, with Upper Deck coming out in 1989 and continuing to raise the bar in quality, and 1991 was really the last year that collectively the card companies just kept pushing out the same stuff that they were making in the late 80s. You know, everybody really took it a step forward in 1992. So I think a lot of collectors were looking for that next Upper Deck, Topps Stadium Club, which we'll talk about in a later podcast. That came out that year. That was kind of the second premium edition. Of course, Leaf Studio. Well, I guess you could say Stadium Club was the third, because Leaf came out in 1990, and that was a pretty good card set. So everybody was looking to up the quality in card standards, and you still had a lot of companies that, even in 1991, they really weren't, and that would certainly be Bowman. They were very much stuck in the classic card design back then. They would change that in 1992. But I can understand why, when you got a first look at those 91 Bowmans, you just went, eh, I'll pass. And that's completely understood. All right. Now, as to the question that I asked on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, and I was really prompted by this card. I pulled the card out of it's a relatively small stack of 91 score. I used to have probably about 1,000 of them when I was a kid. I bought a couple of boxes back then, but I managed to hang on to the stars and the rookies, so it's probably about 20 or 25 of them now. But when I pulled the Sosa card and I saw that 1917 turn back the clock uniform, I went, wow. And it made me wonder, okay, for our listeners, what is your favorite throwback uniform? And keep in mind, too, when this picture was taken back in 1990, the whole turn back the clock and throwback thing, that was still a good 10 or 15 years away. Not too many teams did it, but then they figured out, hey, we can sell merchandise with this. So even though you look at some laughably awful jerseys that were made in the 1970s in particular, but you had some in the 1980s as well. Well, not only is what's old is new again, but some of the really tacky designs from then have come through. You know, even the White Sox have made, I think they wear it on Saturdays, the uniforms that they wore from 82 to 86, as Paul Lucas of UniWatch calls it, the beach blanket bingo uniform, because it does look like a beach blanket. And it's very, I always thought it looked like the Michelin Man, to be honest with you. If the Michelin Man put his belt up around his nipples, that's what that uniform looked like. But, you know, even some of the rather corny designs from that era have come back, and they're very popular. Just look at what the San Diego Padres did with the All-Star game this past season. And while there's a longing for the old Padre Brown to come back, and the Padres are slowly bringing it back, I don't understand why they just don't go back to brown and gold. Clearly the fans want that. But you know, you just look at what the Padres did. Let's be honest. Some of the Padres jerseys from the late 70s were god awful, but people kind of like that for some strange reason now. So I asked, what is your favorite throwback uniform? And in no particular order, we have Selecto Speed, old Expos blue road uniforms. Tim Raines never looked better. I agree with you, and it's so funny. The Montreal Expos, very much like the Quebec Nordiques of the NHL, I remember back in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, looking at both of those uniforms, and that really, you know, the Expos had the true powder blue. The Nordique had more of a darker blue. But the Nordique also had that ridiculous little igloo stick logo, and the Expos had that very artistic and slightly bizarre M logo. And I remember looking at this as a kid going, who would want that? I mean, you know, I was 11 or 12 years old going, what, this is ugly. But now you kind of like them, mostly because both teams no longer exist. But you look back at some of those uniforms and you go, you know, that wasn't so bad. So I like that selection there. Cardboard Clubhouse, the Astros rainbow throwbacks from the 80s are wonderful. You know, I kind of agree with you. You know, the Astros, a lot of people have been pining for that one. When it comes to the Astros, I actually like the look that they have now because it is very similar to the original Astros uniforms when they changed their name from the Colt 45s to the Astros in 1965. I've always liked that. I've liked the shooting star, which you don't see in the new uniforms, but you saw in the ones in the late 60s. But I've never been a huge fan of the rainbow jerseys. I kind of like them. It's like, oh, yeah, look at those. And then at the same time, it's like, oh, my eyes. So yeah, I could see how some people like them, but I've never been a huge fan of them. I think the Astros have had some better uniforms, particularly, again, in the 60s, as opposed to the mid to late 70s and into the early 80s when they still wore them at home. Ground Chuck also says the Astros Tequila Sunrise jerseys, and he adds the Pirates pinstripes with the pillbox hat and the Cubs powder blue pinstripes. Oh, let's start with the Cubs one first. I do not like the Cubs powder blue pinstripes. Those look like pajamas. I think I had a pair of pajamas like those. Of course, the powder blue pinstripes, they wore those in the late 70s up until 82, I believe. Not a big fan of those, but hey, to each their own. The Pirates pinstripes with the pillbox hat. I've always liked the pillbox hat, even though the combinations that the Pirates had, because they had not only the pinstripe uniforms, but they also had all gold, they also had all black, and then they would mix and match. So you may have the pinstripe top and the all black bottom, or you'd have black top and the gold bottom. You know, they had about 18 different combinations. So that was a little confusing. But I think when you go back to the We Are Family Pirates, the 1979 World Series champions, despite the mixing and matching, that uniform actually looked very, very good. And considering, you know, in the 70s where things were very garish, of course, the colors of the uniform pretty much spoke to that. The pillbox hat was very much a throwback, certainly to the early part of the 20th century. And of course, the Stargell stars. You had to have the Stargell stars. Box of Cubs, 80s Cubs roadies. Ugly, yes, but I choose them for sentimental reasons. And actually, I like the 80s road uniforms, and these are the ones they wore from 83, I believe, through 89, before they got conservative. And they wear a similar third jersey to this. It's the dark blue. It's almost like a batting practice jersey with the white pants. And I've always liked that. Like I said, I didn't like the pinstripe ones from the late 70s, but the slightly more conservative, the Rick Sutcliffe, Andre Dawson look that they had in the mid to late 80s, I've always liked that. Peter Steinberg, coming back to another comment from him. If anyone votes for the Rays, please disqualify them from appearing on future broadcast. Well, especially if you're talking about the inaugural Devil Rays jerseys, those were just an abomination. I will say, however, I do have a jersey from their second set where they had, it was predominantly green and white, and they had gray road uniforms. I have a Joe Borowski road jersey from the, I think it was 2005 season. The Rays, and this is their previous ownership, they were selling it at a fan fest, and they called it game used. I think I bought it for $50. The more I look at it, the less I think it's game used. They may have had a bat boy just toss it out onto the turf and step on it a few times. But I've always liked the Rays. I think they wore them from 2001 to 2007. Now, the teams were really bad, so the team looked bad in them. But I'm a big believer there's not enough green in sports uniforms these days. So I actually do like that. That's not my favorite throwback. I'll share that in just a little bit. Now, Peter says, Baltimore Orioles orange. Yes, I do like that. I don't like the all orange, which they did wear in 1971, and the team has broken that out a few times. That just really looks awful. They look like tangerines, which I'm not a big fan of. So I agree with the orange look, but not the all-orange look that they broke out, again, just a few games back in 71, but a few times since then. With the orange tops, they did wear that quite a bit in the late 70s and early 80s, and I do like that. Let's see, Ben Adams, the powder blue Cardinals uniforms. Yeah, I like those too, and we're talking, what was that, about 75, maybe 76, up until I think 86, I think, was the last year they wore those, or 85. No, they got rid of those before they went to the World Series in 85. So 84, I think, was the last year they wore those. Yeah, there's something about the combination of powder blue and dark red, cardinal red in this case, that looks very appealing. And I actually, not that long ago, several months ago, bought a throwback Twins uniform from the mid to late 70s and early 80s, the road uniform. And I've never been a Minnesota Twins fan. I've had no need to, you know, buy any merchandise with a Twins logo on it, but it just looks good. Somehow that dark red on top of the powder blue just works really well. So yeah, the original Ozzie Smith, the 82 World Series Cardinal uniform, Joaquin Andujar beating up a clubhouse toilet. No, I think that was 85 when he did that. But anyways, to your point, there, Ben. Yeah, the powder blue Cardinal uniforms are a winner. Now, I'm certainly looking forward to anybody else's comments on the throwback uniforms. Just respond on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. My favorite throwback, the one that I have a personal attachment to, of course, being a Blue Jays fan as a kid, I at first didn't like them, because when I became a fan, they had just gotten rid of the road blue uniforms. But ever since then, The powder blue Jay's unis have become a favorite of mine. And years ago, I bought it's a 77 Blue Jays, a replica jersey. It's powder blue, and in dark blue, it says Toronto across the front with the Blue Jay crest, you know, right on your stomach. And it's a great jersey. And I love, you know, even though I've moved on from the Jays, like I said, as long as I've lived in Tampa Bay, that's 16, 17 years now, I've been a Rays fan. But I love that a few years ago, the Blue Jays said, we're putting the blue back in Blue Jays. Not really sure, you know, what the Jays ownership, Rogers Media, was thinking or doing back, what was it, 2003 or 2004, when they dropped the word blue and they tried to do this metallic silver look, you know, it didn't work. So it was great that they brought back the Blue Jays and the old 1970s, you know, typeface on the front of the jerseys and the logo as well. Now, they don't wear the powder blue on the road anymore, but I do recall a few years ago for some home games, they wore powder blue, which was very confusing, but that's my favorite. John Stemple, I just discovered your podcast, and I love it. Well, thank you so much for discovering it, for listening to it, and following us at Wax and Gum Stains. John, if you can do me a favor, tell all your friends about the podcast. We do release our podcast every Tuesday and Friday via Audioboom and iTunes, and we're going year by year, set by set. So if you collect in the late 80s and early 90s, chances are you'll find a set or a player that we do our random pull that you're really going to enjoy. And also, check with your friends who own a business, have a certain product or service that they want promoted. We are looking for a sponsor for the program so that we can not only connect that product or service with our listeners and vice versa, but also cover some production cost for this podcast. Very low prices. And again, I promise to our listeners, we're not going to flood you with commercials. Few live reads in each podcast. That's all we're looking for. So I follow pretty much everybody who follows this account, Wax and Gum Stains. So if you have that product or service or know somebody who does, just reach out through direct message and we'll certainly try to come together with a deal. All right, now what's the deal with 91 Score? It is a set that, again, through appearance, I've grown to like a little more and more with time. Now, at the time that it came out, I remember thinking, well, you know, even in 1991, I thought this looks 1991. I remember opening those packs and thinking there's a little bit of Crockett and Tubbs here. And I don't even know if Miami Vice was still on the air then, but it definitely had that South Florida kind of feel to it. And it's a set that does kind of get stuck in time with some of the design elements, but it has some really good photography, some really good stars in there as well. Not a very good rookie class, but some really good cards in here. The problem is, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, way, way, way too many of these cards are out there. And in part because this was a massive set, 893 cards. If you bought the factory set, you got 7 other cards that were not available through the general public, you know, through wax packs and stuff like that. So a 900 card set, that is just way too much. Now, you have Upper Deck through their base set and then their High Number series. That came out to 900 cards. You had Topps with their base set and their traded set. If you combine the two, you actually have over 900 cards. You have almost 925 cards, I believe. But just putting out this massive set all at once and in two series. So you had a big print run for series number one. You had a big print run for series number two. You had a big print run to put together all of those factory sets. This is, I think, probably the best example of absolute gluttony. This is kind of the tipping point if you look back at baseball cards. Now, many sets would continue to be created over the next few years that had a ton of cards in them or a ton of subsets or insert cards. But I think this is kind of the tipping point where things were just getting out of hand. You not only had more and more and more sets being made, but now you have more and more and more cards from all of these sets being produced. And this is what has really kind of killed the hobby all these years later. Now, the hobby's doing just fine now, but there's a reason why a lot of us abandoned baseball cards by the mid-90s, certainly, and that's because we all had boxes and boxes and boxes and boxes of these cards, no matter how nice they were, no matter how good the star power, no matter how good the rookie class. They were practically worthless because, you know, the common card was maybe 3 cents. And even the star cards from a set like Score, you could only get maybe a dollar for them. So if you were looking to make some money in the hobby and trading and collecting these, this was probably the worst set to do it with, certainly in 1991. Now, with that said, there's some pretty positive things about the set. And let's take a look at our random pull, card number 256. Now, I've joked before that the 1990 Fleer set was Hammer Pants and Living Color and, you know, all those other fun names that we came up with. But I really think that the 91 Score set, even though it is certainly dated, it does have a 1991 look to it, still stands the test of time, despite the fact that it is 25 years old, and in some cases, it looks like it. First of all, when you look at the border of the cards, now in 1988 and 1990, Score had the Skittles collection of colors. You had 110 cards that were red. You had 110 cards that were orange. You had 110 cards that were yellow. Well, here they used the same color scheme in each of the two sets, but the colors were very different, which of course gives it the 1991 look to it. You had dark blue. Then you had kind of a teal color, the kind of this, you know, light greenish blue color. Then you had black, which looked very sharp, and then you had white border cards, which were normally saved for top prospects, rookie cards, you know, first round draft pick cards, all-star cards. And you also had some insert cards in this set. You had the Dream Team cards, which featured some of the biggest players at the time, a couple of them with their shirts off, which as a teenager is very awkward. You feel very, very undersized when you're seeing, you know, barrel-chested Kirby Puckett or Jose Canseco just, you know, swinging the lumber. And I mean, they're bad. Don't think we're going any further with this conversation. So you had those, but then you had some really neat ones too. Like I know Doug Jones was holding a ball that was on fire, and Frank Viola was holding an apple. Of course, the Hempstead, New York native moved on to the Mets. So you had some neat cards there, some neat cartoon all-star cards, some neat highlight cards. Also a card, and this was in the Series 2, a card of the American flag, and that was kind of an honor of the veterans returning home from the first Gulf War. Very patriotic time at this time. So you had some good looks to it, and when you look in particular at the Sammy Sosa card, first of all, you have the horizontal picture, which is something that more and more card companies were doing in 91 and certainly into 92 and 93, just to kind of mix up the look a little bit. And you have Sosa in those throwback 1917 Chicago White Sox unis swinging, and looks like he's actually making contact with the ball at the old Comiskey Park. You know, you always tell Comiskey Park by the yellow railings around the box sections in the lower levels there. So you have a very entertaining action shot here, again with a throwback uni, in a park that's no longer around. So it's a very unique picture. And then on the back, you had the standard Score stuff that they started in 1988. You had the player photograph, and all cards had the player photograph in the back of the card designed horizontally. It wasn't just because the Sosa card was horizontal, but all cards had this. So you had the picture, which was in full color and a little larger than what you used to see in previous sets on the left. Right beneath that picture, the data of the player, you've got the card number, and then on the right, the player's name and position in the upper right-hand corner, you've got the player's stats, and then the scouting report style statistics and storytelling at the bottom. And I've always liked the scouting report style that they had on the back of those cards. So no exception here. Sammy Sosa very accurately being predicted as a future star with the Chicago White Sox. Oops, they would trade him later to the Chicago Cubs. But he was a star, albeit controversial, as we'll discuss, but a star nonetheless. So when you look at just the design of the 91 scorecard, it's actually it's actually very good. It's not great. It's not Upper Deck. Again, it wasn't quite the upper echelon of cards that were being produced back then, but it was a pretty good set. And again, with the alternating colors, the dark blue, the teal, the black, and the white being repurposed in Series 2 as well, you had different colors, but it wasn't the Skittles look there. It wasn't just primary colors. It was a very alternate selection of colors that certainly stood for 1991, but all these years later doesn't look bad. Now, the downside to the colors, especially the solid darker colors, is that the condition of the cards, it was very hard to keep them in gem mint conditions. So a card, especially like the Sosa card, and if you look very carefully in the upper right hand corner of this picture, you see there's just a little bit of flaking, and that's just, again, the black on top of the white card stock, and then 25 years of shuffling around from one box to another. It's finally taken its toll on that card there. So you've already got a set that's overproduced. You've got a card set that, outside of big stars, doesn't have a really big rookie club that people can gravitate around. Well, then you've got the damage to some of the darker colors, the dark blue and the black, and that kind of takes away from it as well. So again, like other dark bordered cards from around this era, it's neat, it looks sharp, but very hard to maintain in gem mint condition. And then if it's not in gem mint condition, you might as well just toss it in a box, because you're not going to get anything for it in terms of dollars. And now you're going to get plenty for just a few dollars. I was looking around just eBay and just a few online stores. The complete set of 91 score I have seen sold for as little as, are you ready for this, $8. Now, that's not including shipping and handling. You're probably going to pay an extra $10-$12 for that. But on the price of the set itself, you're getting the set for quite literally less than a penny per card. That's a testament as to how much of this stinking set is still out there. So you can get a complete set, if you so choose, for an extremely ridiculously cheap amount. The same goes for wax boxes, or plastic. They were Score was wrapping their cards in the soft plastic wrappers even before Upper Deck made the foil packages. You can get Series 1 boxes for an insanely cheap price as well. Again, not including shipping and handling. I've seen them for as low as $4. Saw one seller selling 5 of them for $20. So, yeah, $4 a box. The Series 2 sets, or Series 2 boxes, excuse me, are a little more pricier. For the very hefty price of $8 a box, you can get Series 2. And the reason why is Score kind of getting in where Upper Deck did in 1990 with the randomly inserted Reggie Jackson autographs. Well, Score had 2,493 signed Mickey Mantle cards. So there are still some Mantle cards out there. Even the unsigned ones have a little value to them. So the Series 2 wax packs, which is where those cards were inserted, you can still find them, and that's why the price is a little higher. But you are certainly not breaking the bank if you're looking to pick up a couple of boxes and just see what you get and try to build a set out of it. You certainly will not be paying back your bank any loans owed to them with these cards, so keep that in mind as well. But if you're looking for a 1991 contemporary-looking set that does have some pretty good cards in it, this is not a bad one. Again, mostly for star cards, really the only rookie cards that stand out, Chipper Jones, also Mike Mussina as well. Now, as for the random pull from card number 256, swinging, slamming, Sammy Sosa. Or as the late Harry Carey would say, if you spell Sosa backwards, you get ASOS. Folks, he literally said that every game, at least one at bat. If you watched a string of Cubs games back in the early 90s, you're like, Harry, I get it. Sosa spelled backwards is ASOS. Now, the Texas Rangers found Sammy Sosa. He was an unsigned free agent, a kid from the Dominican Republic. They signed him in the summer of 1985. He comes up through their system, and while he's got some glimmer of hope, he does not necessarily stand out. In fact, he came up in 1989, played just 25 games, hit .238, hit one home run. He hit it off Roger Clemens. Oh, the irony in his brief time with the Texas Rangers. But then the Rangers traded him to the Chicago White Sox. Now, before you think, wow, that was one that really got away, also involved in that trade, Wilson Alvarez and Scott Fletcher. Now, Fletcher had a decent career as a utility infielder, but Wilson Alvarez also had a productive few years as a pitcher for the Chicago White Sox. He was an all-star in 1994, and he also has the rather unique historical tidbit of being one of the few pitchers who on his stat line for one season has an infinity as his earned run average. He made one career start in 1988, I believe it was, didn't record a single out, actually gave up two home runs, three earned runs. He got the hook, and that was it. So that is the rather ignominious Texas Rangers career for Wilson Alvarez, who, like I said, actually had a decent few years with the Chicago White Sox, and then he bounced around a little bit, San Francisco, Tampa Bay, also the Dodgers. Was never able to regain his all-star form from the mid-90s. By the way, his one start was in 1989, so my bad there. But still, his earned run average for his Texas Rangers career is still officially infinity, because he couldn't even record a single out while giving up a couple home runs and three earned runs there. So the trade, as it goes down, you have Wilson Alvarez, Sammy Sosa, and Scott Fletcher going to Chicago for Harold Baines and Fred Manrique. Now, Baines was winding down in his career. Manrique was the definition of utility infielder. So definitely the White Sox got the upper hand in that trade. But right before the 1992 season, the White Sox trade Sosa along with Ken Patterson to the Chicago Cubs for George Bell. Now, Patterson was an unremarkable pitcher, but Sosa, of course, would find success with Chicago, the Cubs, while the White Sox were hoping for George Bell to return to his 47 home run days as a Blue Jay. Well, he had some productive but definitely declining years, and by the end of the 1993 season, George Bell's career was done. So definitely a lost trade there for the White Sox, as Sosa not only started hitting more for power with the Cubs, but he was also starting to hit more for average. Now, he still struck out quite a bit during his days with the Chicago Cubs. You just look down some of these numbers here, 174, 171. In fact, he had 171 strikeouts twice in a row. That's for 97, 98, and 99. He led the National League in that department, but he could still make some contact. Even though he was striking out 170 times, he was hitting .308 in 98. He hit .288 in 99, .320 in 2000, .328 in 2001. So despite the steroid allegations, I have yet to believe that performance-enhancing drugs would actually enhance your ability to connect the bat to the ball. Now, would it give it an extra 15 feet in the air? Certainly. But I don't believe there were performance-enhancing drugs that could actually help your eyesight and timing. So you do have to give Sosa some credit, even though all those seasons of 60-plus home runs are in doubt because of all the accusations and leaked reports that he did test positive back in the late 1990s. You still have to give him some credit for making contact more often than not. Of course, Sosa becoming an all-star in 1995 and then becoming a part of the American baseball love fest in 1998 with his home run chase with Mark McGwire. And even though a lot of people were going nudge, nudge, wink, wink during this race and subsequent years, people still ate up Sammy Sosa, because Sosa was this kind of lovable goofball. At least he was, you know, in public eye. I've heard some reports that he was actually quite the prima donna to deal with. But this was a guy that, you know, if you had to choose one player over the other, Mark McGwire over Sammy Sosa, you know, McGwire was more stoic, while Sosa was a little bit of a goofball. And certainly if you have to choose, you know, picking Sammy Sosa versus Barry Bonds, well, a lot of people thought Barry Bonds was an asshole. So they sided with Sosa because he seemed to be a lot more fun-loving than Bonds ever was. Now, he would continue these home run hitting exploits for the next few seasons. He also, I recall, in 2001, shortly after the terrorist attacks in New York City and Washington, D.C., He hit, I want to say, maybe his 60th home run of the season, and he was still in a chase with Barry Bonds, who would finish with 71 that year. And I remember after he dropped his bat, somebody handed him a little miniature American flag, so he's running around Wrigley Field with this American flag, and the place is going bonkers. But I remember back then, I'm thinking, in light of the terrorist attacks, this was the corniest, dumbest, prefabricated event I have ever seen in sports. It was just awful. It just didn't look right. And, you know, I know you're trying to drum up some good feelings. Everyone's scared and upset and sad, but it just came off rather poorly, in my opinion. So his career continues with the Chicago Cubs. And while there are all sorts of allegations going on, as he gets older, his numbers naturally start to decline. He's starting to hit around 250, still popping 35, 40 home runs. But the Cubs, at this point in time, after missing out on getting to the World Series in 2003, by 2004, the rebuild was starting to get into full effect. So they trade him with conditions and cash to the Baltimore Orioles in exchange for minor league pitcher Dave Carruthers, Mike Fontenot, and Jerry Hairston Jr. So this was really a dump for both teams. You know, the Cubs unload a somewhat problematic story with Sosa, and they also unload a little bit of salary, while the Orioles only took on part of the salary of his deal, and they move three players at once. Doesn't do very well in Baltimore. He and Rafael Palmeiro were teammates, again, ironically, in the 05 season. So after the 05 season, he is granted free agency. Did not retire in 2006. He was looking at other offers. The Washington Nationals, just looking for a big name then. They were starting to rebuild. They offered him a minor league deal, which he turned down twice. Well, lo and behold, in 2007, the Texas Rangers, well, they offer him a minor league deal, essentially the same deal that the Nationals did. Well, since nobody else was biting, he signed with the Texas Rangers and would play very briefly for Texas in the 2007 season as a designated hitter. And he certainly didn't put up a bad season, hitting 252 and 24 home runs, but at 38 years old, was not exactly the type of draw that he was just 10 years prior in Chicago. Afterwards, he toyed around with coming back, but it turned out that that was not going to be the case. Nobody wanted him, of course. His career pretty much tainted by all the steroid allegations. Nobody wanted to take a chance with him, so his career was done. He actually retired in 2009, and he said that he was ready to go into the Hall of Fame, well, because of all the steroid allegations at that time and the rumors. You know, he was on that same list of players who allegedly used performance-enhancing drugs along with David Ortiz. Well, nobody voted him into the Hall of Fame. He is still on the ballot. He has not fallen underneath that 5% threshold, but I believe the most he's ever gotten was like 13.2%, and that was in his first year. I actually have the numbers here. 12.5%, I give him too much credit, followed by 7.2, 6.6, and 7.0. So while he's still on the ballot, the chances of him actually getting into the Hall of Fame anytime soon are slim to none, which is unfortunate. You know, if he did dabble in that stuff, there's a consequence to pay. There's a price for that. But again, here's a guy who, by all means, had a good personality, was a good contact hitter, but because he may have been adding a little extra something to his body to make those pitches go a few feet further and make a few more home runs go his way, he is going to be punished in that sense by not getting into the Hall of Fame. So there you go, Sammy Sosa, or as Harry would say, Isos, if you say it backwards, our random pull card number 256 from a score set that is much maligned, and rightly so. Again, there's some pretty good design elements. If you're just looking at the cards themselves, they're actually pretty good. But the fact that there is just way too much of this out there, and there's not very good rookies, and the set itself is just too big, this one, it flops. But if you do want to pull together a set, like I said, just have a set to pull together and look at some pretty neat cards from 25 years ago, you can do that really cheaply, very cheaply. You can buy those boxes. Like I said, you can get series 1 and 2. You can get probably 4 or 5 boxes of each for a grand total of $25, $30, or save yourself the trouble, buy the complete set. As I said, I've seen it for as low as $8. $1,000. Now, while the 91 score set has not been able to withstand the test of time in terms of values, even though its design is pretty good, 91 Upper Deck has. Now, it does not command the market that the 89 set does, but Upper Deck continued to raise the bar in 1991, and with the bar that they raised on their own product, they started raising everybody else up. Because like I said, you had Leaf come out that year, Stadium Club came out that year, and by 1992, everybody else had to up the ante to keep up with Upper Deck. But in 1991, they were still the lead horse in this race, and we will take a look at the 91 Upper Deck set and our random pull on Friday's Wax Ecstatic. Again, give us a follow on Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Let us know about your favorite throwback uniform. We'll throw in a few more in our next podcast, which comes your way Friday. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for listening to Wax Ecstatic.